Boy, you're one tough audience. Yes, sir. What are the practices that might work to help you in this process of awakening and stabilizing and becoming more aware? Well, generally the categories you work with are the heart, the mind, energy systems, and the social working with stuff of the world would be another way of talking about it. They all interact, and there's no pure one that's quite pure, but when you begin to see how much your awareness is entrapped by your thought, and you see that inside yourself, and you see that your thoughts, you wake up in the morning and you start with, I got to go to the toilet. What was I dreaming? It's warm in bed. I got to do my laundry. I wish I could smell coffee. I got to go to the bathroom. And it starts, and your mind goes all day long, and you're going wherever it takes you all day long. Think this, yeah, think me, I'm real. And you keep going all day until you fall exhausted into bed at night. Once you see your predicament, then you say, as Thomas Merton did, if you would like to save yourself, you got to find a place to stand from which you can save. If you got to find a rock, otherwise you're just in the river of thought. So you start to pick a... like a primary object of meditation. You pick one thing and you say, all right, I'm going to, for 20 minutes, I'm just going to keep my awareness there as much as I can. And every time I think of something, I'll just say, it's another thought, and I'll come back. In other words, I'm trying to extricate my awareness from identification with thought. So I'll pick my breath, for example, rising, falling, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. This will never work. That's a thought. See? Now, usually, before I realize it's a thought, this will never work, you're right, well, I'll try something else. I want to hear another method. However, you've agreed for 20 minutes you're just going to follow your breath. So, and if you've got a teacher, the teacher will say, bring your awareness back to your breath. Bring your awareness back to your breath. So you go and you come back and you say, gee, I nearly went on that trip, and you come back. And then breathing in, breathing out, I'm hungry. See, well, I'll go to the refrigerator. No, come on back. 20 minutes breathing in, breathing out. You keep doing this, that's a practice, until your awareness is able to stay with one thing, which we're never trained in school about doing, by the way. Never. We are trained that thinking mind, we train the thinking mind about what to think about, but we don't train awareness as to how to get free of thought, because we don't recognize that possibility, because we think cogito ergo sum. So, that's a meditative practice. There's an example. A devotional practice is practicing seeing the beloved in all the forms. So I'm at the checkout counter at the supermarket, and who's checking me out? You know, it's my guru in drag. It's God who says, I bet you think I'm a checkout person, you know? It's the ability to see through the veil and see the face of the beloved. In all the people that were being treated with eye care, these were all the faces of the beloved. It's when Mother Teresa says, when she's working with the lepers in Calcutta, she says, I am dealing with my beloved Christ in all his distressing disguises. That is a practice. That is a practice of using relationships as a vehicle to awaken to a deeper truth of who we are. That's a devotional practice. You can start with, say, singing to God, singing. And you start out and you, like, you want to sing to Jesus. And you start out imagining Jesus as somebody like Harry, another person, somebody you love what he's done, you love who he is, you love his ability to know God. You just love him as a friend. And you're singing to your friend. And you're just loving your friend. As that love, if you do this over time, just keep doing it, after a while, the romanticism of the relational quality will start to be overridden by a way in which you and Jesus are sharing a space together. You come into a different relationship with your beloved, where it isn't needful or grabbing, or it isn't romantic anymore. It is both, we are together in love. It's a different place. If you keep doing that, and then you go into deeper states, which are often called trance states, but that's just one label for it, you come into a place where you and Jesus aren't what the issue is. Those were just the priming of the pump, the pouring the water and the catalyst. What's happened is you've gone beyond it, and there is just love is. And that's all stages of devotional practice. That's all working with the heart. Working with the energy is holding breath, bringing pranayama, bringing energy up your spine, working to, because as you move energy through your body, your emotions change and your mind changes. So you've got to see the different strokes for different folks. That one person can sit in meditation and another person that's off the wall. And the best way they're going to get into a quiet space of awareness is through running, or through Tai Chi, or through service. These are all different practices. Am I dealing with your question? Yeah. Can I have a couple more? Yes? Past? Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because as you awaken into the present moment, you will see that what you call your past, it's the past of the ego, first of all. And it is a past in which there are attachments to certain feelings and certain attitudes that are strong in there. And to bring those into the present moment is part of a spiritual practice. It's enfolding the past into the present. I'll give you an example. I used to be a pilot, and I had many hair-raising experiences, and I should be dead. And they're wonderful stories, and I can overbear, I'll tell you them. What I find is, when I go to tell those stories, I turn back into that person that I was then. That person who was trying to have fun, who was a different person than I am now. But if I'm not careful, when I tell the story, I noticed when I tell those stories, at the end of a time, I'd feel kind of yicky, like, what am I doing here? I don't want to be in this space. And then what I've learned how to do is go back into my past, but hold on to my mindfulness at the same moment. Stay aware, and then go into those feelings, and then feel them, and then bring that into the awareness of the present moment. So that if I am holding a grudge about somebody or something in the past, when I go back into that, I feel the grudge and the anger and the closing, but the mindfulness allows me to see with compassion why that person was the way they were, why I was the way I was. And as I bring that clarity to bear on that past event, the power of it starts to loosen, and I start to be able to keep that past event in my present world without getting trapped in the emotions that were attendant to the past. That's okay? Yeah. Boy. Yes. That's what karma is. The manifestation of karma is our attractions and aversions. Okay? Yeah. Yes. The best part of Buddhism is the appreciation that it's a do-it-yourself process, that you have to do the work, and that you have to, the process is one of your shift of your own awareness and identity. And the idea that it's not mediated by anybody, nobody can do it for you, you do it. And Buddha basically said, you do it and you'll experience what I experienced. But he doesn't say, I'll make you experience it, or join me, or become a Buddhist. So at the highest level, Buddhism is not like a church. It doesn't function that way. The deepest people that understand Buddhism are not churchgoers. Buddhism does have a church game connected with it, but that's for people who need church, for whom it's, they're basically using it a devotional practice, I love you, Buddha. That's their path. That's not a bad path, it's a different path. But basically, the Buddha isn't saying that. Now, everything that comes from the East, you watch with horror as the essence of it gets ripped off in the Western culture. We're masters at marketing something because our faith is so flickery. And what you see is you go through these different traditions and you meet these menches. It's a Sanskrit word that means you meet beings who sort of are where it's at. And you meet them in every religious tradition. And when you meet them, you feel in them, like in the Dalai Lama, for example, a tremendous respect for other traditions, a respect for all these different ways. And a realization that, as Gandhi said, my life is my message, that their inner work is what they're offering to other people. And that's at the best of it. And it is wonderful to find such a person and to be around them. It is not necessary, but it's wonderful. But people that promise you things, they're doing it out of whatever reasons they're doing it. That's their problem. You come at it with a pure heart, you'll get something pure out of it. And when you're not having anything pure, walk away. All I can say to people about seeking spiritual practices is trust your intuitive heart about the validity of what you're doing. And if it doesn't feel good, no matter who tells you it is your way and it is the right way, screw that. You can't hear it. Trust your own heart. That's very, very, I mean, if I have one bit of advice, because I have looked at situations where I've gotten into taking teachings from a teacher who was caught in various stuff, who was using their teaching for something in their own ego trip. And while I got something out of it, and I got something out of leaving them as well, I can see that even at the beginning of those relationships, I knew there was something in me that knew that this wasn't right, but I wanted it so bad, I made believe I didn't know. You hear that one? Am I dealing with your question? Yeah. It's 3 minutes past 10. We should stop, but why don't we go about 10 more minutes? Those of you that need to leave, okay. Question, yes. Absolutely right. I mean, you're absolutely right that what you're cultivating is a mindfulness of your own predicament. You're not trying to change the predicament. You're just seeing the predicament for what it is. But that other level of seeing it from someplace else changes it. That's actually the way it happens. Yeah, I agree. Yes. Yes. Say it once more. Oh, and the election results. I've been trying to think of what I have learned, what I'm learning, because I've been through a merry dance, because I'm a liberal, which is a weird thing to be these days, but I am nevertheless. And I'm in pain. I mean, I'm in pain about the political process in this United States. And I invest heavily in it. I mean, I campaign and I raise money and I do all that stuff. And I look to it to be compassionate. And I was trying to figure out what's happened because I've had a hard time in my love affair with Bill Clinton over these years. Because I really heard an intelligent Rhodes Scholar trying to wrestle with social problems, and I thought, I'll back that kind of a person. And then what I saw was that he made compromise after compromise, and at first I tried to rationalize that, saying you've got to move to the center in order that we all go along together so we don't polarize the culture, and I gave plenty of space for that to happen. But I thought that isn't really what the issue is. As I've looked at the political arena this past few weeks, I've begun to see that there is a basic distinction that in politics you really feel that the ends justify the means. And in wisdom traditions, you understand that the means and the ends are a piece. That's the difference. And I feel now that we are getting to the point in our culture where we aren't going to quite settle for politics just as what it is. There is more that we want from that institution. What we want from that institution is people whose the way they govern is part of the statement, not just that they govern to bring about a good effect. That's a major change. I think we all feel uncomfortable somewhere in our beings about this social structure at this moment. And there are obviously things that we'll have to change in terms of, you know, selling the election at auction and all that stuff that's going on these days. But I think that one's a key one that I want to point to at this moment. Okay. And I still see that in the 60s, when there was some kind of awakening in the culture that I talked about in my personal life, but it happened across the board with, I mean, it was very complexly overdetermined in the society by, and it was reflected in the civil rights, in anti-Vietnam, in sexual freedom, in environment, the awakening of the environment movement, in da-da-da-da-da, on and on, in psychedelics, in the minstrels of the rock and roll movement. I mean, it was all being spread. The whole thing was a tremendous shift of consciousness. The experience that many of us had of being in the middle of Woodstock or the Haight-Ashbury or whatever that was that what we were experiencing was so intuitively valid that everybody ultimately would agree. The fact was that we underestimated how scary all that was to people who had a strong investment in the way things were. And what they saw was chaos and anarchy. And that was as much our naivete was as much a precipitator of the reaction that was for the next 20 years as anything that conservatives did. We, in a way, invested them with reality. And what I see now is that in the 90s, there is the possibility, I don't think consciousness has gone away. I think naivete has gone away. And I would like us to be innocent without naivete and have the quietness and the compassion and the appreciation to understand people do get frightened and act in a way politically, in a way to bring it all together rather than being divisive and playing the game of who's more righteous. I don't think righteousness is not the optimum strategy for the political arena. Questions? Well, I'd first suggest you enjoy it. That would be first thing. I would say that you understand that the species reproduces through sex. I mean, in case you didn't know that fully, I want to reassure you that that's part of it and that you have to give some space for other beings to come along. So you have a responsibility just as a species carrier about reproduction. You don't have to, each individual doesn't have that, but I mean the collective sex must be looked at as a at some level as a functional entity for reproduction. It seems to me often that sex is the main spiritual practice in this culture because it is a vehicle through which more people get to the edge of non-dualism through orgasm and the yearning for it and the playing with it than any other way I can see around. I think power is running a good second, but that's already third chakra, and I think it's somehow between second and third chakra that we're really playing out this game on earth in this society. So, I mean, I wouldn't knock any method that will get you closer to surrendering your ego and feeling the totality, which this does. It's, for many people, it's quite momentary. I don't mean the eternal moment. I mean a temporal moment. And then people get into Tantra and they can spread it out for several minutes or something like that. Let me say that individuals differ dramatically in what practices will be the practice that they will use in order to transform consciousness. And it is only for some people that sex is a primary vehicle. For others, when they are young and that power is strong, they are pulled to deal with it one way or the other. And then as they get older, they get the hormonal intensity relaxes and they start to get a different context for it. And the story I tell all the time is about the older man like myself walking down a street and he hears somebody say, "Psst, could you help me out?" And he looks around and there's nobody there. So he walks another few steps and he hears, "Psst, could you help me out?" And he looks around and there's nobody there. But then he looks down and right there is a huge frog. Now, this man is a humanist. He's not used to talking to frogs. So, but nobody's around and nobody else is around. So he says, "Did you speak to me?" And the frog says, "Yeah, could you help me out?" The man says, "Well, what do you want?" "Well, I'm under a curse, and if you will kiss me, I will turn back into an absolutely beautiful maiden, and I will warm your bed and cook your food and take care of you in a way you've never enjoyed before. I mean, it'll be so superb." So the man stands there for a moment, and then he picks up the frog and he puts it in his pocket and he walks on. And after a little while, from his pocket comes, "Hey, you forgot to kiss me." The man says, "Well, you know, at my age, I think it's more interesting to have a talking frog." You know, I think that's enough. I think we'll end with a talking frog. Thank you very much, everybody. Namaste.